Though not graphic, this episode contains discussion of sexual assault and trauma. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. In 2020, we spent 10 months researching the Southeastern victims of serial killer Samuel Little. The result of that work was a four-part series focused on their cases, highlighting both the victims who have been identified and the unmatched confessions and unidentified women who still wait to be matched to missing persons. During that work, we were lucky enough to connect with Amy Hutzel. Amy is a fellow Georgian whose work on the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative Task Force, or SAKI Task Force, brings her into contact with a number of cold cases, victims, and advocates across the Southeast. Specifically, you might remember her work on the case of Frances Campbell, a Savannah-area victim of Samuel Little. It was Amy and her team who matched Little's confession to Frances's unsolved homicide case and helped bring answers to Frances's family after decades. Amy's work in the state of Georgia is both wide-reaching and fascinating, touching on issues that affect many of the cases we cover: victim support, funding for case resolution and forensics, and trauma-informed advocacy. This spring, Brooke sat down with Amy to discuss those topics and more.
I'm Amy Hutzel, and I'm a program director for the state of Georgia, the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, and I oversee the Sexual Assault, Child Abuse, and Human Trafficking Unit. So in the Sexual Assault Unit, we have several statewide projects, one of them being our Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, or Georgia SAKI Task Force. And that is a task force that was created using grant funds from the Bureau of Justice Assistance, which is a department of the Federal Department of Justice. And we were originally awarded about $3 million to form a multi-jurisdictional, multidisciplinary task force. So what that means is we brought together prosecutors, investigators, and victim advocates to work together pre-COVID in the same location on cases that resulted from sexual assault kit backlog testing in Georgia. That task force consists of local level investigators and prosecutors, and then also state level investigators and prosecutors. So what that enables us to do is focus in those jurisdictions where we have actual representatives on the task force, but because we have statewide investigators and prosecutors, we're able to assist other jurisdictions really throughout the state in the cases that they're dealing with at their local level as well. We also brought in a victim advocate who works with the task force, and that victim advocate works with local advocates on cases and works directly with victims on the cases as well to ensure that the re-traumatization that may occur from revisiting cold cases is addressed and the services are available to those victims from a counseling or therapy perspective or a general advocacy perspective as well.
You talked about sort of the re-traumatization. It's sort of the pile-on of additional traumas once a sexual assault has happened, and then the victim goes to seek medical services and interact with law enforcement. Can you talk about how those procedures have changed throughout time to address this additional trauma on top of trauma?
Sure. I think we've come a long way in the way that we as a criminal justice system respond to sexual assault in recent years. There has been a lot of focus on what we call the neurobiology of trauma and how a victim is impacted by that assault from a neurobiological perspective. So, and I'm not a scientist, and so I'm not an expert in the science behind the neurobiology of trauma, but essentially it's pretty basic. And what I tell law enforcement across the state when we're training them is what you really need to understand is that when an individual goes through trauma, there is an influx of various hormones that can occur in their body that results in what could be interpreted as counterintuitive behaviors. So what may seem like an odd behavior may be explained scientifically through that release of hormones in the body. So back in the day, investigators didn't have access to that knowledge. And so victim behavior may have been interpreted incorrectly as that victim being inconsistent in their statements because those same hormones can also cause fragmented memories. So in law enforcement, for example, when there is an officer-involved shooting, it is standard procedure for that officer to have at least 2 sleep cycles before he's interviewed about that incident, because that was a traumatic event that occurred, and law enforcement understands that. So we often put it in those terms. It's kind of like when an officer is involved in a shooting, how they're typically not interviewed for 2 days. Victims of sexual assault and trauma need that same type of sleep cycle or time to let those hormones get back to normal before they should really be interviewed intensively. There's always going to be a preliminary interview so that responding officer can get the facts of the case. But when they really want to sit down and start to interview a victim, it should be after 2 sleep cycles. So that's one example of how we kind of know better now. And a large part of some of the work that we do in Georgia and training law enforcement is making sure that they understand that. We also have access to better investigative techniques. Our CODIS database over many years has increased and improved as an investigative tool because, as we know, with any database, the strength of a database has to do with how much information is in it, right? So as we have worked through some of our rape kit backlogs and sexual assault kit backlogs, we're increasing the number of profiles, which then strengthens rather the effectiveness of that investigative tool. We know a lot more now, and we have a lot more tools at our disposal as a criminal justice system in terms of being able to respond to a sexual assault within our communities. We also know more about how we should work together as a team. So we know that the best case scenario is that a victim has a response that is collaborative, that it includes not only law enforcement, but a victim advocate, a sexual assault nurse examiner, a prosecutor. And so that multidisciplinary representation what kind of supports that victim through the criminal justice process in a more collaborative way. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it has progressed in the sense that we know more now and we are able, I think, to respond in a way that is better informed and more consistent with best practice. We're not totally there because we still have a long way to go to get all of our responders to understand these concepts, but we've made quite a bit of progress. I think now I can say in the state of Georgia, because I think some of the efforts that we have set into place to educate law enforcement about sexual assault response teams and what we call a trauma-informed response as well, that the chances of a victim receiving a response that encourages that continuing presence within the investigation, their chances are better of getting that response. And so I think that helps us in the way we respond in the state.
I wanted to ask sort of a twofold question. I know that Georgia may be different than other states in the country, but I can't imagine that we are the only one who has a backlog of rape kits. And I would love for you to explain, how did that happen? And then also, is Saki involved in ending that backlog?
So, okay, how do backlogs happen? It's a combination of things. Some of the reasons why rape kits were not originally tested has to do with what we've talked about the way we used to respond as a criminal justice system. So, for example, if a victim was not believed for whatever reason, then they law enforcement may have been less likely to value that evidence and actually spend the resources to get it tested. There were also policies in place sometimes that prevented it. In Georgia, for example, there were policies at the crime lab that have evolved over time. And so at one point, and I cannot give you the exact years, but at one point, the crime lab only wanted to receive that evidence, for example, if there was a suspect that had been identified. So as policies have changed over time, law enforcement agencies have had to adjust and adapt to whatever the policies have been previously at the crime lab. And I'm sure that that is consistent across the state as well. As a result of better education and improved policies, there was an initiative that began in Detroit and in Houston to start to test rape kits. And so it became a national issue, and there was funding behind it. In Georgia, we received funding from the District Attorney's Office of New York. So in Manhattan, they had additional funds that they received from, I think, some high-profile Wall Street-type prosecutions, and they had cleared their backlog in New York. And so Cy Vance, who is the district attorney there, decided that because those funds were kind of restricted, that he wanted to make them available through a grant process to other jurisdictions across the country. And so we were fortunate to have been the recipient. We applied for funding and we got $1.9 million to test our backlog. At that time, and this was in 2016, the Atlanta Journal and Constitution had just published an article about approximately 1,500 sexual assault kits that had been found in storage at Grady Hospital. So we knew through that kind of media focus that we had what was the beginning of a rape kit backlog in Georgia. At that time, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office took possession of those sexual assault kits from Grady Hospital and sent them to the crime lab. So that was the beginning of the backlog in Georgia. Then our legislature got involved. So later that year, in 2016, Senate Bill 304 was introduced and it ultimately passed. And that changed the way sexual assault kits flow through the process in Georgia. So under Senate Bill 304, law enforcement agencies had until August 31st of 2016 to determine what sexual assault kits were currently still what we call unsubmitted to the crime lab in their jurisdiction. So that may have been from hospitals or from sexual assault centers. They needed to take possession of whatever kits were in their jurisdiction. They needed to combine that with whatever they may have had in storage as well, and they needed to get that to the crime lab. So by August 31st, 2016, the crime lab now had another influx of sexual assault kits, and there were over 3,000 that came in at that time. To address future backlogs, the law also stated that going forward, law enforcement should collect a sexual assault kit within 96 hours of collection. So if a victim undergoes a forensic medical exam, a sexual assault kit is collected, law enforcement had to pick that up, and then they had 30 days from that point to get that evidence to the crime lab. So the Senate Bill 304 had two purposes. One was to go ahead and get everything to the crime lab that needed to be tested, but then also prevent those future backlogs. And the final part of Senate Bill 304 required that there be a report that is submitted to the governor and the legislature every December from the crime lab. And so by December 2016, we learned that there was an additional over 5,000 sexual assault kits that had been in storage at the crime lab that dated back to pre-1999. So this evidence was not tested previously because the testing wasn't available. Again, their policies had changed. And so that evidence became part of our backlog as well. So we started outsourcing kits. I say we, the crime lab, started outsourcing those kits because the crime lab is very overburdened anyway in terms of the amount of evidence statewide that it has to process. And so instead of increasing the workload of the existing forensic analysts, those sexual assault kits were outsourced to a third-party lab. And so they developed DNA profiles. They sent it back to the crime lab where it underwent a technical review to make sure it was meeting the standards of the crime lab. And then those profiles started getting uploaded into CODIS. And so really by mid-2017, we were starting to see CODIS matches or CODIS hits that were resulting from all of that testing. So that's when we realized that we needed more resources because now the burden is on the law enforcement agencies and the prosecutors who need to be taking a look at those cases. So that's when we applied for our Psaki funding that created that task force to specifically take a look at those cases. We've evolved since that time on our task force. We ended up applying for additional funding. So to date, we have approximately $6 million in grant funding, and we have evolved in that project to include sexually motivated homicides. We worked on the Samuel Little cases, and we are looking at sexually motivated homicides across the state as well that have remained unsolved to seek closure for the families of those victims as well. One of the first things that we looked at even before we applied for Psaki funding, because we knew that the hits were going to come. We knew that when you test rape kits, you're going to start getting these CODIS hits. And so we looked as kind of a work group at best practices in victim notification. And so we took some research that was available to us from the National Institute of Justice, the Joyful Heart Foundation, which is Mariska Hargitay's, Detective Olivia Benson's foundation, is also very involved at the national level in ending the backlogs across the country. And so they had done a good bit of research as well. So we took a look at that research and we developed victim notification policy recommendations and templates for policies that local jurisdictions could adopt. Because again, what we know is that a sexual assault is traumatic in itself. But when a victim kind of puts that away on a shelf for 10, 15, 20 years, one can only imagine what that re-traumatization is like. So one of the kind of anecdotal stories that I like to make people aware of when we're doing training is a story that I had heard about a victim notification that had been done in a way that wasn't really consistent with that research. And at that time, this particular jurisdiction didn't have access to the policy recommendations that we had made. They didn't have access to the research, so they did it in the best way that they knew. But what happened in this particular case was that a victim who had been assaulted 15-ish years prior was notified by uniformed police officers who appeared at her home with a marked police car and knocked on the door to notify her that there had been a CODIS hit and her sexual assault, and her husband was present and her children were also home. But that was how her husband found out that his wife had been sexually assaulted, because she had never opted to tell him. And so that was obviously very traumatic for that victim. And so what we recommend is, one, that there always be a victim advocate present on notification, that it is done in unmarked police cars, in plainclothes officers or detectives, because that way the neighbors aren't wondering what's going on at the house. And that, again, that that victim advocate is present to make sure that those emotional needs are met as well. And we also recommend that if there's a way to find out in advance how that victim would like to meet, that that be respected as well. So whether that be that they prefer to meet in a neutral location, or maybe they want to come to the district attorney's office or the law enforcement agency, that that all be taken into account, and that there be a little bit of front-end investigation into that victim's life circumstances prior to notification. One of the things that I like to do is utilize law enforcement trainers to train law enforcement. And a trainer who can stand up in front of a room of investigators and say, I used to do this a certain way because that's how I was trained, then I learned better, and now I do it this way, is really one of the most effective training tools, I think, because they're hearing it from someone in their own profession who has also learned to change the way that they have looked at these kinds of cases.
Much of this work is made possible through grants. Funding is always an issue for any initiative, and Amy Hutzel's teams have managed to secure funding for many of their projects.
I have a team within the Sexual Assault, Child Abuse, and Human Trafficking Unit, so we usually take a team approach to writing grants. I have been the primary grant writer on many of the grants, but I have now fortunately been able to delegate a good bit of that work and empower my team to be able to take the lead on some of the grants that we write as well. So it really is a team approach, and not only with my unit, but also at CJCC, we have a statistical analysis center, and they always are very, very helpful to us as well in how we are meeting the data and reporting requirements within most of our federal grants.
Yeah, I think sometimes I was unfamiliar with how strenuous it is to apply for grants, especially large grants.
Well, it does take a team effort. Like, I could not do it without the assistance of the amazing people that work in the sexual assault unit and in the human trafficking unit and our child abuse unit. Like, it really is a team approach. And we've been really successful, I think, not only on the sexual assault side, but on the human trafficking side, and being competitive about the grants that we're applying for and being awarded. So we're really fortunate that we have those resources.
Well, so speaking of that, if you had the funding to secure any single thing to aid in resolution of the cold cases in Georgia, what would you choose?
Well, this isn't a funding thing. I can tell you if I had a magic wand, what I would want. And that would be that our evidence and record keeping within law enforcement agencies was improved. We have so many cases where we can't find evidence, or evidence was destroyed, or we can't find records. And it's so challenging when you're talking about cold cases, because our investigators spend a lot of time just tracking stuff down. And sometimes the answer is we don't have it anymore. And that's really devastating to an investigation. We have had the opposite as well. The Fredonia Smith case, for example, in Macon, those records were perfectly maintained and very easy to get to. And so there's the opposite as well. But it's one of the biggest challenges that we have. And so from a funding perspective, I think to answer your question, I think at least in Georgia, funding for a centralized location to store and properly maintain evidence for the long term is needed. It could also be used as a repository for sexual assault kits that are not part of a criminal investigation. In Georgia, as with most states, sexual assault victims are entitled to a forensic medical exam regardless of whether or not they report the crime to law enforcement. And so under state law, law enforcement agencies are required to maintain that evidence for a year. They're not allowed to destroy it. We had talked earlier about the neurobiology of trauma, right? And how victims sometimes need time to process. And so the theory behind going ahead and collecting evidence, whether or not the victim wants to report or not, really is based on the thought that, one, that victim is entitled to the medical attention regardless, but also that we want to go ahead and collect that DNA evidence because they may very well change their mind and decide that they do want to report, especially if they see that they're being supported by a victim advocate through the process. So I say all that to say we have what we call unreported or non-investigative sexual assault kits that law enforcement must maintain, and that puts the burden on them. And in something that is not actually a crime from an investigative standpoint because it has never been reported to them. So that kind of centralized evidence facility could very much help us with that problem as well, where those non-reported kits could be stored as well until such time that they can legally be destroyed, although best practice would say keep those forever too, but that victim changes their mind and that kit becomes a reported kit or a investigative kit when it goes from potential evidence to actual evidence. So I think that's my long spiel about, I think if I had a magic wand and enough money, that would probably be what I would find most helpful, not only for the investigations that we're working on now, but for future investigations too, because there'll be cold cases that happen today, 20 years from now as well.
Like so many of the people we've encountered in the past 4 years, Amy Hutzel has not had a conventional career path. She didn't start out to head up a task force that, among other things, tackled Georgia's sexual assault kit backlog. She told us about what led her to this work.
Years ago, I was working in the private sector. I worked for a real estate company that was owned by it was a real estate company and a restaurant company that was owned by a Greek millionaire. And I loved my job in some ways, but I really felt called to not just be making rich people richer, to actually do something with my career that would give back to the community. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I just started looking and I applied for every job that I could find in the nonprofit sector. And so I had no interest really specifically in the field, but I landed at a place called the Gwinnett Sexual Assault Center and Children's Advocacy Center. And I took the job because I really, at that point in my life, wanted to just be doing something that meant something other than, as I said, making rich people richer. So I kind of fell into that. And I stayed there for a decade, and I advanced within that agency to assistant director. And I learned from an amazing mentor, who was the executive director of that agency, a woman named Ann Burgess. And I learned everything that she knew. And she's someone who was well known at the national level. She's now the board president of EVOLWE, or In Violence Against Women, an agency that, or an organization rather, that you probably know of. And so she was just kind of a badass and an expert in the field. And so she essentially downloaded her brain into my brain as my mentor. And I was there for a decade. And so it became my life work as well, because I really grew to understand the importance of that kind of collaborative response that we've talked about before, and the concept of sexual assault response teams and being trauma-informed, and the difference that it can make not only in the lives of victims, but in the community as well. And so it was very rewarding. As with any direct service work, there comes a point when you need to make a change, right? Everybody needs a break for mental health purposes. And so my break came after almost a decade at that agency, when I decided that I would open a bakery. And I realize that sounds really random, but I was... I was, as a stress reliever, baking. We would be on call 24 hours a day a lot of times. And as the assistant director, of course, I had a team. But when you're responsible, you're always the next call, right? So I had to be available 24 hours a day. And my cell phone, or I'm dating myself, but back then, way back then, we started on pagers, and then we eventually got cell phones, but my pager or my cell phone, it would go off at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was not, you know, four or whatever. Like, it was not at all unusual. So as a first responder like that, that work can be very stressful. So my stress reliever was baking. And so I had developed what I thought at that time was a significant portfolio of different recipes and so forth. And so I decided I would open a bakery. And so I did. We specialized in cupcakes and cakes. And I was open for 4 years. It was called Sugar Moon Bake Shop in Decatur, Georgia. And it was a wonderful experience. And it was a wonderful break from my criminal justice career. As I said, it was a nice opportunity to just do what I thought was going to be less stressful. But as it turns out, being a business owner is no less stressful, than working in the field that I'm in now. So, eventually I made my way back to the state, and I started work at the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. I was hired originally just to oversee one project, the sexual assault response team project. I was doing both at the time. I had a management team at the bakery that was able to keep things going while I was also focusing on my state career. But then as things progressed, I was taking on more and more work and creating more and more projects. And so it became a little bit too much. So I ended up closing the bakery, but it was a wonderful time in my life, and it was a nice break from the day-to-day kind of ups and downs of working in the criminal justice field.
Yeah, what's amazing to me is maybe having the bravery to just apply for jobs in a different field, a field that you had not worked in before, because I'm specifically thinking of our listeners. A lot of listeners have a passion in this area, but they may not have specific training. And I'm thinking about how many people might be able to look into a career change. It seems like it takes a lot of guts on your part.
Well, I appreciate that you're calling it bravery. I might call it a little crazy, but I do think, you know, sometimes you gotta, I've always been a person who kind of dives into the deep end of the pool. And so that works for me. It doesn't work for everybody, but I've also truly believe that I'm guided in a certain way. And so I land where I'm meant to be. And so I have faith in that as well.
We're glad that Amy dives into that deep end of the pool, because it's what led her and her team to sit in dusty file rooms for days, searching through case after case, determined to check every possibility for Samuel Little's confession matches. And though Little has died, that work isn't over. Amy has connected us with friends who continue it, and we hope to interview them as well. As for Georgia's sexual assault kit backlog, which was famously written up by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, per WTOC News, by 2018, those original tests were cleared. But as 11 Alive reported in 2021, the GBI continues to receive roughly 250 new tests a month. And there was a new backlog of somewhere around 2,400 tests after the initial backlog was cleared. That's why a recent Georgia state bill is so important. House Bill 255, or Sexual Assault Reform Act of 2021, proposes a system to better track that evidence. Specifically, per the AGC, quote, evidence gathered from sexual assaults would be tracked through Georgia's criminal justice system, helping to ensure cases move forward, according to a bill pending in the State House. The legislation would build on recent state laws that required police to save sexual assault evidence and clear backlogs of untested rape kits, end quote. This bill allows not only advocates, but also survivors to track the evidence in their own cases. It was recently approved by Georgia's lawmakers, but still must be signed by the governor, Brian Kemp, to become law. Many, many thanks to Amy Hutzel for discussing her work on the SACI Task Force and on other programs, and for participating in last year's series on the victims of Samuel Little. We'll keep you up to date on the continuing work to improve cold case resolution and survivor advocacy in Georgia. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us over on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Milberg Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just $1. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Jessica Ann. Family and law enforcement interviews are by Brooke Hargrove. Produced and engineered by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to private investigations for the missing.